This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and this is The Current. It is Thursday. That means it's mail day at The Current, and our Friday host, Wei Chen, is back with us and in better health. When we last spoke, you weren't speaking.
Good morning, Anna Maria.
Wow,
I am
listen
much
to that.
Better.
A voice.
I didn't, you know what? I could not speak for over a week.
I know.
Can you imagine?
I know you couldn't, but you couldn't speak when you were in here, too, So it's nice to have you back. Let's get to the mail. The latest data from Statistics Canada put a spotlight on two big suburban centres, Markham, Ontario, and Richmond, BC, where the majority of residents were born elsewhere. Yesterday on The Current, we looked at how immigrant communities like these are working. One voice we heard was of Meyer Simiatiki. He is the director of the Graduate Program in Immigration and Settlement Studies at Ryerson University in Toronto, and he gave us a bit of an historical perspective.
Successive waves of Eastern European, Jewish, Italian, Caribbean, there have always been immigrant neighborhoods. You know, you can think historically in Canadian cities, Fletcher's Field, the Plateau in Montreal, Spadina, Kensington Market in Toronto, the north end of Winnipeg. So these have always existed. I think what's different in recent decades, firstly, is the incredible high and sustained levels of immigration, and that they are moving into suburban areas and municipalities, drawn largely, I think, by more affordable housing and less housing stock available in the central city.
Meyer Simiatiki is the director of the Graduate Program in Immigration and Settlement Studies at Ryerson University in Toronto.
After hearing that, we heard from David Camfield of Winnipeg, who writes, "I found much of the discussion about ethnic enclaves disturbing. The discussion treated these communities as something problematic and important to discuss. There are many communities and neighborhoods in Canada that are entirely or overwhelmingly white, but we don't hear shows discussing these white ethnic enclaves and worrying about their implications for society and whether it's a problem that white children only have white friends. The problem that needs to be discussed is the systemic racism experienced by people of color in Canada, not the fact that there are communities where they are the majority of the local population."
David Camfield of Winnipeg. Christine Maitland of Toronto shared this perspective. "As a black Canadian born and raised in Canada, I find all the hoopla about the number of immigrants amusing and am reminded of an incident from my university days at the University of Toronto. I got into a debate with a schoolmate. She was white with blonde hair, and she had a bee in her bonnet about Asians. All these Chinese people are taking our spots. We will never get admitted to the school, given how many of them there are," she fumed. "I got up and stood in front of her. I pointed to my black skin and said, 'What do you mean, we? It's all relative.'"
That's from Christine Maitland of Toronto. Keeping with the topic of immigration, for many Canadians, the phrase reasonable accommodation might make your eyes glaze over, but in Quebec, it has been a very real issue. For the last 2.5 months, the Bouchard-Taylor Commission has been touring the province to hear Quebecers' thoughts on how far the province should go in accommodating religious and cultural diversity. Last Friday on The Current, we heard a sample of the diverse views aired at the hearings, and that discussion led to a broader conversation about multiculturalism and just how comfortable we really are with each other.
That conversation continued in the mail. This first email is from Susan Bromley of Red Deer, Alberta, who writes, "Your feature on reasonable accommodation immediately followed two successive telling news items. First, we were informed that Muslims were calling for the execution by firing squad of a naive teacher who permitted her students to name a teddy bear Muhammad. This was immediately followed by a prediction that in the near future, Canada's population growth would be completely reliant on immigrants. Forgive us, listeners, for connecting the dots and fearing for our future and our grandchildren. Do you really expect us to believe that those particular immigrants will pride themselves on tolerance and respect for our beliefs when we're the minority? Ask the British teacher."
Susan Bromley of Red Deer, Alberta. And Gilles Saint-Jean offered these thoughts from Gatineau, Quebec. He writes, "The biggest issue in Quebec seems to be more about religion than immigrants. Until recently, Quebec was a very religious province where the Catholic Church had much control. The church dictated who to vote for during elections and told us to keep having kids even if it kills you, because God would want this. Quebecers are not afraid of immigrants. They are afraid of a potential return of religious power into the social consciousness."
That comes from Gilles Saint-Jean of Gatineau, Quebec. And one of our producers, Dominic Girard, was working on the reasonable accommodations study, and he happened on a Government of Alberta immigration website that he found particularly interesting. So we asked him to join us this morning to tell us about it, and he's with us here in the studio as well. Good morning, Dominic.
Good morning, Anna Maria. And this webpage you mentioned, it's part of a new immigration portal the Government of Alberta launched just last week. It still has that new web smell.
New web smell. Okay, a new portal.
Yeah. Well, there have been a few websites from a number of provincial ministries involved with some aspect of immigration. So they just amalgamated them all into, you know, one massive portal, alberta-canada.com.
alberta-canada.com. Now, is it a kind of a clearinghouse of immigration information for people wanting to move to Alberta?
Yeah, that seems to be the idea. It's everything from, you know, applications, access to statistics, employment assistance, and even advice for living in the province. It's managed by the Ministry of Alberta Employment, Immigration, and Industry.
And there's one particular webpage that you're here to tell us about.
That's right. It's called Stories from New Immigrants. It's a series of profiles from recent immigrants to the province. The page is actually, it's a bit hard to find if you're just casually browsing the site. I came across it by way of Google, ever-powerful Google, and that's the best way to do it, really, if you want to find it. Just type Alberta immigration stories, and it pops right up.
So what are these immigration stories?
Oh, well, that's the part that got my attention. But rather than tell you myself, I'm going to let Jim Gurnett tell us. He's the executive director of the Edmonton Mennonite Center for Newcomers. So I called him up, and I asked him to open up the webpage, and, well, here's his reaction.
Yeah, well, there's a little bit of introductory text, and then there start to be pictures of these profile. Sorry. Well, there's pictures of a couple and a single man and another couple and another single man and a family, two adults and a child. But my absolute first observation, Dominique, is that every single one of these people at the website are white, European names. So let's see. Arriving from England, German machinist, down under duo, so that must mean, yeah, when this Aussie Cup Australia, this good sport from France, and lifestyle is jolly good for British couple. This is really hard to believe, I'm afraid. Honestly.
So Alberta's immigration portal has a page full of stories from new immigrants, and every one of those stories is about white Europeans?
Oh, and a white Australian couple, but they're European descendants too, if you go back far enough.
So Dominic, that might lead me to assume that Europeans must make up a good proportion of immigrants to Alberta.
Yeah, and that's a reasonable assumption, so I checked the 2006 census data on that. And between 2001 and 2006, Alberta received over 103,000 immigrants.
And how many of them are from the four countries of the people on the webpage, Germany, the UK, Australia, and France?
Just under 6,000. So statistically, 6% if you round up.
So 6%, and they get the whole webpage.
They do, the whole webpage. Take Stéphane Carloni, for instance, the one described as the good sport from France on the webpage. He's one of only 205 people who moved to Alberta from France between 2001 and 2006. And remember, that's out of over 103,000 total immigrants at the same time.
So how does that compare to the number of immigrants from non-European countries?
Well, just like the rest of Canada, Asia is at the top for Alberta. And over 36,000 people immigrated there from China, the Philippines, and India combined. That's basically one-third of all immigrants to Alberta.
So what's this website trying to show?
Well, that's a good question. I gave a call to the Ministry of Employment, Immigration, and Industry and got a public affairs officer there to clear this up for me over the phone. And Jason Maloney, you'll hear from him in just a moment. He defends the page while at the same time admitting that they've been told it perhaps needs to be changed. See, focus groups made up of people from around the world, Maloney points out, they did review the whole portal and they reviewed the page as something that needed work. They identified it that way. But no one, it seems, suggested it needs to be any kind of priority.
So they did their homework to see if they had the right feedback, checking for feedback on the website, but why didn't they find immigrant stories that would better showcase the majority of people coming to Alberta?
Well, although there are Europeans who immigrate to Alberta, and their stories are valuable too, you do have to wonder, why isn't the diversity properly represented?
And so do they have an answer to that?
Well, yep, here's Jason Maloney.
The profiles on the page right now were not chosen based on country. We sent out a whole bunch of invitations asking people to share their stories. So when we received back the information we did, we posted the ones that said they would allow that information to be posted up on the website. I'm not sure why we only have a certain number of stories on there from a certain part of the world.
So after he told me that, I asked him why they didn't just approach organizations within Alberta that, you know, work with immigrants every day, people like Jim Gurnett at the Newcomers Center. And Maloney says he's not really quite sure why they didn't ask these kinds of groups.
And do you think that would have helped?
Well, don't ask me. Let's ask Jim Gurnett.
Oh, if they had come to my organization alone and were one of 20 organizations in the province providing services to immigrants, we could have found them five wonderfully diverse stories to tell within a day. Articulate people that have stories that would capture the real issues that most immigrants coming to Alberta really do experience.
So Dominic, what happens next with this website then?
Well, as far as they've told me, the website will stay as is, and eventually the plan is to update the page if and when they can gather new stories for it. But as Jason Maloney explained, it's really not a priority. The priority, they say, is ensuring that visitors to the new site have clear and easy access to the information they need, the kind of stuff they need to know to make the move to Alberta. And then once they've moved, perhaps these new immigrants can start building their own stories.
Interesting. Okay, Dominic Girard, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Anna-Marie.
Dominic Girard is a producer with The Current. You can find a link to the Alberta Immigration website on our own website later today, and our website is www.cbc.ca/thecurrent. Well, getting back to the mail, from grocery bags to your lunch containers, from your telephone to your upholstered chair, plastic is everywhere. But for all the convenience that plastics afford, we may be paying a deadly price. Tuesday on The Current, we heard about additives to plastic called plasticizers. Some plasticizers are suspected of being endocrine disruptors, which mimic hormones in the body. Other plasticizers have shown to be toxic and carcinogenic in animal studies.
Victor Satov is an environmentalist, and he also works in the chemical industry selling additives for plastics. He writes from Mississauga, Ontario. There was no input from knowledgeable parties who present different perspectives which are equally valid for this debate. Imagine the state of healthcare without blood bags and IV tubes. These have been in use for about 50 years. All are made of PVC with phthalate plasticizers, and all studies can find no link between phthalates and ill health, though there is all this direct exposure to humans. Endocrine disruption by phthalates has been put in doubt by recent studies. One guest on your program said industry is scared. This is simply one man's perspective. Society and industry learn of issues together, and as they are identified, the chemical and plastics industries respond simply by acting responsibly. That was Victor Satov of Mississauga, Ontario. And here's another message from our voicemail with a friendly warning for you, Anna Maria.
Hi, my name is Polly Davis. I'm in Cape Breton. Anna Maria, I'd like to ask you, please never refill your water bottle because it's made out of number one plastic, and that plastic breaks down very quickly and gives off estrogen-mimicking substance. Gallon bottles of water are number two, which is not so bad, but don't refill those number one bottles.
That warning was from Polly Davis in Cape Breton. So have you changed
your
ways?
Well, you know, I heard it this morning. I've been dragging the same water bottle around forever. So I looked around and I filled up the coffee cup that I come in with, which is also hard plastic, probably Nalgene, probably not great either. So I guess I'm going shopping later today.
We're
going
to get you
something
a mug.
With a cap on it.
How's
no,
that?
No, I'd have to drag it around in my purse. But she makes a good point, and I hear her, and thank you for that.
We also receive lots of emails and calls from people wondering how to deal with plastics day to day. Allison Petten is a registered nurse and also a board member with the Environmental Health Association of Nova Scotia. She addresses some of that in this email she writes from Halifax. Plastics are everywhere, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed, but it's actually quite easy to make small changes that have a big impact. For years, I have taken my water to work in glass bottles.
Okay, there's my
there
clue.
You go.
Okay,
our
reading.
Son takes drinks to school in a stainless steel sports bottle. We use glass jars to refrigerate or freeze foods and casserole dishes to reheat meals. We never put anything warm in plastic and have not used plastic wrap for 15 years.
Well, some suggestions from Allison Petten of Halifax. Living in a plastic world as we do, it would seem next to impossible to avoid the plasticizers. And a number of our listeners wrote in asking how we could do that, avoid some plasticizers. And so we asked Kathleen Cooper to help us out. She's a senior researcher at the Canadian Environmental Law Association. And she is not only in our studio, she's brought toys. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you have? You've got plastic wraps and plastic bottles?
Just some examples of where these plasticizers are and some positive examples of where you can avoid these products.
Okay, so let me ask you, in our segment on plasticizers, we heard about a study that estimates that our bodies are taking in 8 milligrams of various plasticizers a day. Where is most of that exposure coming from?
It's dietary, mostly, from food wrap, and it's fatty foods in particular, because those chemicals move from the plastic more readily into fatty foods.
So if I've wrapped cheese, for example.
Or meat with a fat layer, and it's also in indoor air. It's coming from consumer products in our homes, and we're breathing it in.
Now, let me clarify. All products contain plasticizers, do they not?
Oh, no, there's a real range. The plasticizers are in primarily the number 3 plastic, the PVC plastic. If you look on your recycling symbols on your products, it goes from 1 through 7, and there's more information in there in those numbers than whether or not you can put it in your blue box. There's also plasticizers in most of the plastic wraps. Not all of them, though. And I brought an example of one company that has a label that says they don't include chlorine-based chemicals in their wrap, which means they don't have the PVC, so chlorine, polyvinyl chloride, that's the one that's softened with the phthalates.
So how do they make the plastic pliable without some kind of a plasticizer?
It's just a different kind of plastic. If you look at those, if you go through 1 through 7, those are all different kinds of plastics. Number 3 is the one that has the phthalate plasticizers of concern. The others have some of these other chemicals in them too. You're focusing on plasticizers. I'm trying to keep it on that topic.
Okay, but fair enough, because we're dealing with plastics without it, and you're saying that they've all got a label somewhere that we can actually read?
Well, labeling, we need to improve labeling dramatically in this country. That's another
issue. That'll be another story, yeah.
And we need to regulate the chemicals in these products. And we also need to use less plastic. But there are better choices you can make. So, you know, the little recycling symbol on the bottom that you check to see whether you can put your item in your blue box, right?
That's a little triangle?
The little triangle with a number in it. And it changes, it varies across the country, of course. The different municipal recycling programs, you know, let you put certain things in or not. So 1, 2, 4, and 5, those are the better choices.
And why are they better?
Because they don't have the chemicals of concern that the ones you've been raising, the plasticizers, which are in number 3. Number 6 is the polystyrene. That's a lot of your fast food containers. Mm-hmm. There's issues with concern about polystyrene. And then number 7 is the one you raised earlier, the polycarbonate plastic that has the bisphenol A in it. And so that's where we recommend glass, stainless steel alternatives.
Instead of a plastic bottle?
Absolutely.
Or a plastic cup even?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like these thermal coffee cups?
Yeah, that one.
I got from there. NPR Public Radio in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, just
little did I know, yeah.
just go down the street to Mountain Equipment Co-op and get yourself a stainless steel one.
Okay, so we can actually look at, and you're saying that, so it's possible to make choices in the kinds of containers we buy and even the wraps we buy.
Yeah.
And, if you want plastic versus wax paper.
Yeah, and we can't shop our way out of this problem. We do need better regulation, but you can make better choices. So 1, 2, 4, and 5, and avoid 3, 6, and 7. And especially 3, avoid 3 in food containers. Rarely you see it, but this is where you see it. This came from a popular restaurant in Toronto. It's the bottom of a big fancy juice container for kids or pot drink container. Pardon me. It has a big fancy straw. This is a little thing that screws in the bottom with a toy.
Okay, it looks like
it.
A cup with a screw, and it's got a toy.
It's number 3 plastic. This is for kids. This should not be used for food at all. And this is given out. I think it might have been promotional, or it might have been for sale. But you can see the number 3 right on the bottom and just avoid number 3 for any food or drink containers.
Okay, and what about microwaving and freezing plastic?
Don't microwave in plastic.
At all.
It's better safe than sorry. You know, we don't have solid evidence about all of these things. It's a matter of choosing to avoid exposures and not being part of the experiment to find out what the effects will be.
And especially, what about freezing?
It's less of an issue with freezing, although when you buy meat and it's in plastic wrap, you can switch that into a thicker plastic bag, the polyethylene plastic bags that don't have the phthalates in them. But it's more an issue with heat, and especially fatty foods. So just use ceramic, glass, those that don't have any metal paint on them. Use a paper towel or a plate instead to, the way you want to keep the steam in or mm-hmm.
Keep stuff from bubbling over.
Yeah. So you can do that instead of using the plastic.
Okay. Now, you brought in a plastic that you say that doesn't have the offending chemical in it. Which is it?
Well, I've got two. I've got a President's Choice one here that doesn't have any sort of indication that it's not PVC, so I'm assuming it is, although labeling is not. It's not there. I just know that this is likely to be the PVC plastic. And this is a Saran Wrap brand. I'm not doing any product endorsement here. But it says, as a result of SC Johnson's initiative to look for more sustainable and environmentally acceptable plastic, the film in Saran Premium Wrap does not contain chlorine. So that's their way of saying, if it doesn't have chlorine, it's not polyvinyl chloride, it's not softened with the phthalates.
Okay,
so it's a better choice.
Okay, but you have to read the small print.
Okay,
and they're not going to say that it doesn't have PVC. They're just going to say it doesn't have chlorine.
Yeah.
And that'll be the clue.
Yeah.
And again, we can turn over the other plastic products and look on the bottom, and there should be a label?
No, well, it's the recycling symbol.
The recycling symbol.
Us with very old eyes, it's hard to read them, which is a bit of a pain. But yes, definitely avoid number 3 for food and drink, and number 7.
Okay.
Although the 7 is weird because it's PC, it's a polycarbonate, and then 7 also gets used for some of the better ones, the corn-based ones, and it'll say PLA. It's a little confusing.
Okay, so 1 and 2 and 4 and 5 are your better choices.
Yes.
Okay, thank you for coming in.
Okay.
Kathleen Cooper is a senior researcher at the Canadian Environmental Law Association. She came into our Toronto studio today.
And finally this morning, the province of Nova Scotia is looking at a bill that would require all healthcare providers to report any incidents involving a gunshot or stab wound to police. If the bill passes, Nova Scotia will join Ontario and Saskatchewan, which have similar laws. Tuesday on The Current, we got a taste of the contentious debate that the proposal is undergoing. Here is the Deputy Chief of the Halifax Police Force, Chris McNeil.
We've had circumstances where we are looking for a victim and we are looking for a suspect, only discover that both sides of that combatant are at the emergency room and people telling us, well, we can't tell you whether they're here. Not only does it harm an investigation in early stages, in my view, it puts others, innocent people who are coming in and out of a hospital at risk.
There are many, many circumstances in the emergency department in which we are dealing with people who we know have committed acts that are illegal. If the patient cannot trust that what they tell us is going to be confidential, they won't tell us, and we will not be able to treat them.
Well, the last voice you heard there was David Maxwell, a retired emergency room physician from the Queen E2 Hospital in Halifax. Before that, we heard from Chris McNeil, Deputy Chief of the Halifax Police Force.
Those differing opinions were echoed in our mail, first to T. Molnar of Calgary, who writes, "There are some prices all of us will likely have to pay to live in a society with a healthy level of personal freedom. If that means police bodies cannot demand that physicians break their confidentiality with patients, then I support this. The sometimes undesired outcome which may emerge is something we need to bear, however unfortunate at times. Physicians should not be put in this dilemma. Police should keep a distance. As one doctor said, the gain by forcing disclosure is small compared to what is potentially lost in terms of the effects on physicians, patients, and the integrity of our healthcare system."
That comes from T. Molnar of Calgary. Barry Epstein of Kagawong, Ontario, offered another side of the coin as he writes, "I was astonished by Dr. Maxwell's assertion that doctors should have the right to be judge and jury in the matter of how a gunshot injury was sustained and thus decide whether to report the individual. If a patient has bullets in him that match those from a gun in the hand of a murder victim 2 kilometers away, who is this arrogant doctor to decide that the police don't need to know about it? The members of the medical community have a responsibility to public safety. Let the police sort out the victims of accidental gunshots or attempted suicide from those who would harm the rest of us."
That was Barry Epstein of Kagawong, Ontario.
Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at The Current, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.